This is Thrive Perspectives, an ever-growing discussion about the issues and ideas that shape our lives with your guide, Dr. Matthew Jacoby.
Matt Connell back in the studio, Thrive Perspectives. Man, it's been an interesting journey so far as we've sort of looked at our Christian worldview and, and last episode we looked at the human predicament and really focused on the challenges of to some degree suffering, but how we got there, you know, the fact that really we've created these are the consequences of our decisions, and particularly obviously we've gone right back to the beginning in Genesis and the decisions made there. Today we're going to continue a little on that as we kind of look at evil and suffering in the world. Connell, welcome. We like usual, we had a good conversation beforehand, and sometimes I wonder if that's probably better the podcast to put out.
I think we've exhausted the conversation.
Yeah, we certainly haven't done that. Great to have you with us, Connell. Matt, as always, where do you want to kick off from, Matt?
The important thing actually here is that we're placing our worldview in a sort of narrative form. It has the form of a story, and that's important because a lot of the big questions that come up are abstract questions that are actually best answered with reference to where we are actually in the story, in the unfolding story. Now, initially, it's a story of the empowerment of human beings, and that's a very important backdrop for the problem of sin, evil, and suffering in the world. The level of empowerment. First of all, the weight that was put on human choice. We may not think that was such a great idea to give human beings freedom of choice, but the idea behind that is that, you know, primarily, you know, we understand God as a relational God, a God who is looking for a love relationship with his children, with human beings. And in order for us to return that love relationship, it requires this freedom of choice. And so that throughout scripture is the supreme good. You know, it's this love relationship, you know, the sort of prime attribute of God celebrated throughout scripture is the love of God. And the first commandment of all is love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. And then love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus says this is the summation of the whole law. So there's no higher good than relationship. This is the top, of the ladder in terms of importance. And so in order to even make that possible, we had to, you know, God gave us this freedom of choice. And of course, choice comes with, well, dare I say it, a sort of risk. Now, it's, you know, it's problematic applying the idea of risk to God. But it does come with that. You know, we had a choice either way, and we talked about that in the last episode. Yeah, and of course, human beings made the choice to reject God, to not trust in God. There was a break in that relationship. And because of the level of empowerment, and this, you know, the key, the other key element, as I said, of that was about that was this level of empowerment, you know, that we were put in charge, that the world was created almost like a physical facet of heaven. It's interesting, in the beginning, you get this sense that heaven and earth are very much one and the same. It's almost like the earth is in some sense a physical facet of heaven, whatever physical means. And then after the fall, you get this sense of separation. Suddenly heaven seems to be some, well, it's almost spoken in terms of spatial difference, but it's not spatial difference because there's a relational rift. There's this sense of separation, relational separation, even though it's not spatial, between heaven and earth. And so heaven seems to be somewhere else. You know, we pray our Father in heaven. Now, that's significant because that separation then is closed right at the end of the Bible. When you get to Revelation chapters 21 and 22, you see a return. You know, then I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. And so you get the reconciliation of heaven and earth. And so you get what is described there as a new heavens and a new earth. Yeah. In other words, a kind of new heavenly earth. It's basically what it was in
before the fall.
Yeah, but before the fall, but maybe in a greater, you know, in a much greater sense. But essentially, you know, you get this picture of the two being united at the beginning, a return to at the end. And in the middle, you've got this tension or this separation between the realm of heaven and the realm of earth. And of course, you know, heaven is not somewhere else like another planet or something. It's something like, you know, another dimension or another, I don't know how you would how you would describe it, but because there's also the sense in which it is present in some sense, and you know, God is, you know, ever present, but as I said, there's this relational rift.
It's not, you know, when you say it's not spatial separation, it's probably, it's almost like it's hidden from us.
It's
an access. Yeah. We don't have the access to it.
That's God
intended.
And this is actually depicted in at the end of Genesis chapter 3, when, you know, the Garden of Eden, you know, whatever that was, and we're not given much explanation, although in the context of the ancient world, as the Old Testament scholar John Walton suggests, that may have been some kind of temple garden sort of thing where this whole drama was sort of enacted. And I mean, he sees Adam and Eve as these two archetypal, almost priestly sort of figures. Mm-hmm. I mean, because the text is very condensed, there is room for conjecture, for sort of educated conjecture. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's not wrong to conjecture. And a lot of those suggestions are interesting. We just don't really know for sure. Mm. It's nice, though, to recognize that there is room there for a lot of information that we aren't really told, because the text is, story is told in a very condensed form. But you do, what you get there is this sort of, this perfect garden, which has this sort of heavenly, and certainly in the context of an ancient Near East, you know, that sort of garden, temple, they were designed to depict a heavenly state of affairs. And the interesting thing, and certainly in Genesis, it certainly is this sort of heavenly state. But of course, Adam and Eve are then cast out of the garden, and the, you know, the cherubim with the flaming sword is put, you know, at the entrance of the garden to prevent them from coming in. Mm. And so they are cast out of that heavenly state because of their rebellion against God. So that in a sense states that separation suddenly. Mm. And it's not like, because then you don't, Eden doesn't ceases to become a place, really, is that, you know? Yeah. Of course, you get the rebuilding of the temple, and in a sense, the temple kind of evokes the idea of the garden, even the fact that the big curtain that led into the most holy place had cherubim sewed into it. Mm. And so there was this idea that this is the pathway back into, you know, the temple is this pathway back into this, you know, heavenly state.
With the heavenly, when you say heavenly state, I mean, the picture that comes to mind is floating around, and it's all kind of spiritual and not what we're used to.
Yeah, right. Yeah, good
but
point.
I think, you know, you listen to people and how much weight you put into, like, you know, your near-death experiences and things like that. But those who say they've experienced that, at least detachment from the physical world that we know now, talk about being more real, more present than we get to experience now. So when we say heavenly state, I think we're kind of something becoming more unreal, imaginary in our mind, some sort of floating dreamlike state. But really the heavenly state was probably like a much stronger, more physical, you know, what's the word? Like it's almost like richer, deeper.
Yeah, that's right.
More vibrant than what we've got now. So
if you look at Christ, I mean, Jesus, I mean, he was the first resurrected. And
that's
we saw how he interacted on a physical world after his resurrection. We read, Paul, I think it is, the cloud of witnesses. So I think, as you said before, we don't have access there, but potentially there's all these people, potentially beings, witnesses watching.
Yeah, that's in Hebrews. Yeah,
yeah, us. Sorry, Hebrews. Yeah,
yeah. Yes. The when I refer to a heavenly state, I'm not talking about a non-physical state. The heavenly state is essentially a state of relational harmony in every respect. And actually, that's a good segue, actually, because that's lost. It's the relational harmony that is lost. So the harmony between us and God, that's the first thing. When that's broken, there's a loss of harmony between human beings, because we, our fundamental identity as children of God, and we're all connected together as something like branches growing out of a vine, to use the illustration that Jesus used. We are, you know, we're like branches growing out of the vine. But as soon as we disconnect from the vine and snap off, you know, we all become these autonomous sort of units in and of ourselves, and so disconnected from each other. Now, that's essentially not real, because the fact is we are actually connected to it. Like, we are actually. But there's a relational disconnection that happens. In, you know, because I mean, the irony is too that we are also continually connected with God. I mean, we're continually reliant on God for the sustenance of our very being. Our the very being and life that we have is actually the very outflow of God. And I know that sounds a little sort of new agey, but I'm thinking, you know, the statement the Westminster Confession of Faith makes as God is the fountain of all being, and utilizing that picture of the branches on the vine, you know, in a sense, for their existence, every person, for their existence and life and consciousness are continually dependent on God, and we are intricately connected with each other. We're very much all interconnected. But there's the relational break that's happened. So this is signified in Genesis chapter 4, this relational break with the first murder. Cain kills Abel, and so you get this increasing sort of, you know, break. Now, what happens from this moment on, from Genesis chapter 4 onwards, for the moment the fall happens, you get this domino effect, right? And God allows the dominoes to fall. Why does God allow the dominoes to? Now, when I say dominoes falling, I'm talking a lot of really terrible things begin to unfold, things that God predicted would unfold when he confronted Adam and Eve in Genesis chapter 3, right? It says, you realize that because of what you did, all of these things are going to happen. And we covered some of those things in the last episode. What you see is the dominoes start to fall and things start to descend back into chaos. And of course, that's depicted in the waters of the flood, the ocean is seen as a kind of symbol of chaos. We saw that at the beginning, Genesis 1 verse 2, the watery chaos in the beginning. And so in a sense, the world returns to that chaotic state. And that's kind of symbol of what's happened with God's perfectly ordered world. It descends into this chaos. Now, God lets the dominoes fall. Why? Because we made the choice. And empowerment means then when we make the choice, the consequences flow from our choice, because the choice that we make is an empowered choice. God put us in charge, and as it says in Romans 11:29, the gifts and the call of God are irrevocable. God doesn't disempower once he's empowered. But essentially, in making that choice, he then allows the dominoes to fall. Now, that doesn't mean that God doesn't intervene. He does, but he's largely committed himself to allowing the consequences of our actions to flow on. This is why in the standard in, scriptures like Exodus 34, the story of Moses, when God says to Moses, I'm going to pass by you and so you can see my glory. Mm. And when God passes by Moses, he declares his name, right? And his name is, you know, showing love and goodness to thousands of generations. And then goes on to say, but visiting the sins of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation. And a lot of contemporary readers find that really vexing. He visits the sins of the fathers. This is in Exodus 34, and it's a number of places, significant places, where God says, this is who I am, right?
Yeah.
In describing who he is, it's the fundamental elements of what God wills, you know, and so he wills to show love. That's the primary thing that it said. You know, he shows love to thousands of generations. He forgives iniquities and so forth. It says that, but he visits the sins of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation. Now, the reason for this is because he has empowered the fathers to the extent that their choices are going to have inevitable consequence
on their children,
their children and their children, right, to the third and fourth generation. Now, we might say, oh, but that's just too much responsibility that my actions, you know, I don't want that much responsibility that my actions should have consequence to the third and fourth generation. But that's what being human is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
See, we automatically tend to shirk responsibility, but that's part of our kind of corrupted human nature. And we saw that in the last episode, Adam and Eve are shirking responsibility, blaming each other essentially, and not wanting to be accountable.
But it's a collective thing too. It's not just down the generations from your ancestors. It's collective in our community that we live. The choices that we make have impact on people that are far removed from us that we don't even know. So
as
a community, because a lot of people will go, well, I'm feeling the effects of, you know, this chaos from things that choices that I haven't even made, that other people have made.
Yeah, that's right. And that's a good point. That comes back to the interconnectedness, because for better or worse, we're all interconnected. So the choice of one person, and I mean, I think we feel this very much in our modern world now. You know, a Russian leader can make stupid choices and decide to invade another country, and the whole world is suffering as a result. You know, that I think we're feeling that interconnectedness because of a political situation, but it was always there. You know, the moment that Adam and Eve made that choice, everyone else was affected. And then everything that everyone did affected everyone else. Now, again, we might say that is just too much responsibility that my actions are going to affect so many other people more than I ever know. But see, that is, you know, that is, again, the responsibility of being human. That's what comes with authority, you know. And our, of course, and that was meant to, that was created for good, right? Mm-hmm. It was meant to be that interconnectedness was meant to aid the flow of love and goodness and blessing from one to another, right? But now it's become a conduit for evil and not for good.
Yeah. And how much we probably diminish the little decisions that we take.
It's
like
right.
pushing a domino over.
That's right.
You know, it does have an impact and an impact and an impact. And why God set up rules or frameworks for us to live in that that we may think are, in our very limited, tiny little understanding, we think it's not that bad or it doesn't really matter, you know. I can, it's just some sort of rule in some, you know, it seems pretty arbitrary and minimal, but it is a framework.
Yeah.
That God has laid out.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
That keeps us in the safety barriers.
Yeah.
It's interesting too, in that passage, I'm not sure if it's that one, because there's a few times that that's mentioned about the third and fourth generation. Mm. It also says to those who love me to a thousand generations.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And that's the dominant note, but there is this sense that there's this flow on. Now, it's interesting, there's a recent book that's come out called It Didn't Start With You, and it's... You know, it sums up a lot of research now that is being done on trauma and on the multi-generational effects of trauma. And what they've discovered is that one person's trauma or something that happens in one person's life, that the effects of that are actually felt with a lot of force to the third and fourth generation. It's interesting in this book. He even quotes, and I don't think he has a faith background or anything like that, but he quotes the Bible to the third and fourth generation, because he's basically saying we're now discovering that actually, you know, trauma, things that happen to someone or even things that they do, like significant things are actually have these repercussions down to the third and fourth generation. And so, you know, I am the product, not just of my parental environment, but even things that happen to my great-grandfather can have a direct effect on me. And it's very interesting. It's a very interesting book, actually. But it just shows how complex actually we are, like how complex what happens to someone can actually affect. I mean, when you go to the third and fourth generation, you really, the ripples are really going out. And talk about chaos. You get this domino falling effect. We got dominoes falling all over the place. And it just shows how complex we actually are. And I think reading that book made me recognize, gee, we are more connected than we thought, right? But we are also far more potentially messed up than we ever imagined that we actually were. If we can be affected that much, not only by the interconnectedness of everyone. And I believe we shouldn't underrate.
Totally,
I think, you know, I think we are, you know, we are affected that, you know, by that. I mean, Carl Jung, the famous psychoanalyst, talked about collective unconsciousness and things like that. But, you know, but I do think there is a sense of everything that anyone does in some sense does affect everyone.
Collective consequences.
Yeah, that's right. Collective consequences. Yeah. And then, you know, add that sort of stuff, the fact that, you know, there's this multi-generational to the third and fourth generation, and we're all experiencing that.
Yeah.
Man, we are tied up in a knot the like of which none of us can untie.
And if you look at the level of anxiety, particularly for young people today, which may not result in anything directly in their generation, may not necessarily, but just what's happening in the world, the collective impact on that for young people, particularly today,
yeah.
Not just young people, but, you know, it clearly it does.
Mm. Yeah, that's right.
One of the, you know, what books I've been reading, New Seeds of Contemplation.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And one of the interesting
things. It's one of my favourites.
Yeah, it's such a good book.
By Thomas Merton.
There's been a lot of time in that book really painting a picture of the depth of sin within us.
Yeah.
And it's kind of opened my eyes to what that actually looks like. Because even listening to you speak now, I feel like there's consequences of the actions that we take and so on, and it flows down through the generations and it impacts other people. But I think in reading this book, one of the interesting things is how much sin impacts my life without necessarily it being a choice or an action that you would think necessarily is
in the obvious sense
is sinful.
Yeah. Yeah.
So even in the good things that I do, there's sin because it paints this picture of being a true self and a false self. And the false self is the thing that's built up, propped up by sin of greed and ego and ambition and seeking pleasure and running away from pain. And really, we all will do what we need to do to try to reach that goal on that, you know, that axis that we've been talking about, trying to get to pleasure and away from pain. And so we'll trample over people, we'll put people down, we'll manipulate situations to our advantage to try to get ourselves there. But so much of what we do that seems like is good is still tainted by these corrupt ambitions that we don't even know that we're operating in that kind of...
Because there's so many layers of complexity.
Yeah, and it's so steeped in this. And it's really made me think, you know, like if I was to go up and encourage someone and say, look, I see someone doing a really good job. Go, yeah, you really did a really good job of that today.
Yeah.
There's like a little switch in my brain that goes, well, why am I saying that to that person?
Yeah.
Is it because I really want to encourage them, or do I want to win some favor with them? Do I want them to like me? Do they?
Yeah.
There's all these things, and they're going, and you start to realize, man, I'm so complicated that I'm not even sure that the good that I do in my life is that, like, for me, sin isn't necessarily just those big pieces.
Yeah.
Of things that I focus on where I know that I fail and disappoint God, but it's not something that I'm always thinking, constantly thinking, oh man, I've messed up here, messed up there. When I look at it that way, then I kind of end up thinking, well, I'm not so bad because maybe my failures are just
here and there kind of thing.
Yeah, that's right. And when I was actually thinking about this, and I was talking about this with someone the other day, and they were talking about feeling like they fail all the time before God.
Mm.
And one of the images that I kind of got in my head of what sin actually looks like is like a beach with, you know, you got all the grains of sand as far as the eye can see. And sitting on top of the beach are these, you know, bigger rocks. And the only things that I can see are the bigger rocks.
Yeah.
And I look at the big rocks, which are the big sins.
Yeah.
And I think, oh, you know, look, I've sinned there, I've sinned there, I've sinned there. Man, I'm a bad person.
Yeah.
But actually, when you zoom in from God's perspective, all the little grains of sand on the beach is sin as well. Like, I'm absolutely dripping in sin in my nature. It permeates through everything.
Yeah.
And the repercussions of that from all the little things that I'm doing as well, or it's all setting up a kind of a...
And people are going to... And I just know people are going to struggle with that because it seems like such a bleak, such a big picture. Now, what we need to remember, the backdrop to that bleak. Is that we were essentially created good. It's important to remember that. We're not essentially bad. We essentially are created good in our essence, right? But that goodness has been corrupted. That corruption is pervasive. And this is... You know, one of the reasons why Thomas Merton in that book, New Seeds of Contemplation, one of the reasons he focuses on that a lot is because that's our liberation lies in the recognition of that.
Yep.
And I know personally that confronting that has been one of the most liberating, empowering, life-giving things because my existence is in the grace of Jesus Christ. Therefore, everything good that comes from me is of the grace of God, like I'm floating in an ocean of grace. And it's not just about this bad thing or that bad thing or this. It is that I am pervasively in need of grace. Now, it doesn't mean that there's nothing good. There's a fundamental goodness, but that fundamental goodness has been corrupted.
Well, even Jesus said, why do you call me good? No one is good.
Yeah, that's right.
Except the Father.
Yeah.
He's the only one.
So we can, you know, I mean, it's easy to not see this. It's a little bit like imagine someone falling without seeing but being blind and not where you don't really, you get so used to the feeling that it becomes sort of normalized because you don't see the ground coming closer to you or, you know, there's no sense of, you know, like if you're out in space or something and you're actually kind of falling, but you don't. And I think we're in a situation analogous like that because we've got, there's something happening that we don't really perceive, but actually from God's standard and from God's perspective, it is really serious. This is one of the things that comes up when we think about abnormal psychology, like abnormal psychology diagnoses certain abnormal conditions. And, it's take something like dissociative identity disorder, where people live through sort of different alter egos. And now, by what standard do we judge the line of normal and abnormal? You know, I mean, one might say, well, it's by the standard of being able to function in our society, function adequately in our society in a way that you might be happy with. That's a pretty arbitrary kind of value because what if the whole of society is also falling? You know, what if we're all falling together?
Yeah.
Then judging your normality by other people isn't really the right, you know, because in some sense we're all doing that. We're all spinning these alter egos that we live through. Mm. It's just that there's a degree that happens that interrupts when we do that a whole lot more than others, that interrupts our ability to function socially. And I'm sorry, I'm not underplaying the seriousness of those disorders. It's interesting that they're referred to as disorders. You know, again, the question is, and this is a question that the French philosopher Michel Foucault, you know, brought up in relation to what was then called madness, you know, in the 60s. Like, you know, his critique was, well, who gets to say who's mad? Yeah. Who gets to say that? And for him, it was a social construct. Now, I don't agree with, of course, with everything that he says, but I think that point of critique was a valid one.
But it's because everything's, it's all relative to the world around you. And I think resetting our idea of what is sin and what is wrong with us shouldn't be based on what the relative standard that that the world gives us. And I think that's the power in this whole idea of going, we actually need to go a lot deeper than just going, I messed up with these things. The depth of the problem within us and the depth of the sin within us, you're never going to get that validation from comparing yourself to others in the world. It's actually got to look at it from God's perspective, which really paints a pretty bleak picture of our condition. And the interesting thing with the New Seeds of Contemplation book is there's a lot of hope. You say it's a pretty bleak kind of picture in terms of just how sinful we all are, even the best of us. Just, you know, it's far deeper than what you're even conscious of. But the point that he's trying to make there is that that's not the identity that God gave us. It's not actually our true
identity. Right. Yeah.
Our true identity is what God wants to redeem. Well, restore us.
That's right.
Bring us back into.
Yeah.
So there's actually.
So the old thing needs to die. And this is the whole point.
Yes.
Is that pervasiveness means that we've got to let that die. God wants to put that to death to actually reconcile us with our true selves.
Yeah. And in this book, Thomas Merton goes through these different scenarios of people, you know, showing how that kind of manifests and the difficulty it is in actually letting go of those things, which is going to be incredibly difficult to let go of them because they're so core to who we are or what we've built ourselves to be. This idea of false self is like we've erected this identity and a mask, it's kind of like a mask. It's like kind of a front to the world and even to ourselves that allows us to kind of exist within ourselves, within the world. That's to attain something that we've got in our mind of what it is that we want to be. And it's propped up by ego and careers and all those sorts of things.
Well, also by normal. You know, as Matt said before, we look around and what's made things acceptable is the fact that they're normal.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
you know.
And it's interesting, this topic of the false self and you know, this sort of false identity that we spin. It's interesting how in civilization, in inverted commas, in its supposedly highest forms, right, those who would advocate for civilization and you know, how much false identity content there is in that, you know, we get to choose who we are and what we become, and our identity is, you know, often relates to, you know, status symbols. And I've lately been reading a number of, you know, classic novels from the 19th century, and because I find that period so fascinating, and particularly one of the things that I find interesting, particularly in English culture in that Victorian era, is the obsession with rank and status and title. And it's like this game that everyone's playing, but it's real for them, you know, and they, you know, we need to be friends with them because that reflects well on us. We can't be friends with them because that'll interrupt our friends with that person of higher rank, because that might draw them down by association. And, oh man, it's so, so complicated.
Yeah.
It's this spinning of a sort of false reality with false identities, a kind of false universe. It's just the craziest thing. And yet this is supposedly, you know, the English nobility, you know, was supposedly sort of the highest expression of civilization. You know, even, you know, I enjoy watching the TV series The Crown, you know, one of the things that they have the royal saying. And this is something that I think has been, and that has been stated in terms about the royal family, is that they kind of stand for English civilization. It's that they kind of stand for, symbolize the height of sort of, you know, that British civilization. And yet it's a civilization that's so problematic at so many levels, because it's been built up on these really shaky foundations. Now, there's lots of Christian influence, and this is the interesting thing. It's complex because there's lots of good stuff there, and we can talk about progress because there are lots of good streams flowing into that. But a lot of that can actually empower also what's bad as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, we probably need to unpack that a little bit and go back to the beginning. But it's interesting, you know, in terms of the false self, how readily we do that as human beings.
Well, you mentioned before as well about we spin things.
Yeah.
You know, it occurs to me there that the spinning itself, well, it's the motives and the agendas that sort of sits behind it. If you were to look at it, you probably weren't doing things that were overtly sinful. You'd be making choices that in themselves, as they stand on their own, there was nothing sinful particularly about them. It's the fact that it's all being spun together to create something.
Yeah.
Because it's actually all being sewn out of dysfunction and sin, and
well, it's actually an endeavor. It's not just it's not out of a negative. It's an endeavor of human beings to weave our own identity. Yeah. And of course, if our identity isn't derived from our relationship with God, then it has to be derived from our relationship with other people. And when I say that, I mean by comparing ourselves to other people.
Yeah.
So for me to feel good about myself, I've got to be better than you. And so you not only get this in, you know, this obsession with rank, you know, in sort of European and English society. It's actually, you know, pretty pervasively in European society, but even been interested in lately in Hinduism and the sort of thought world of Hinduism. And it's very much there as well. And, you know, the caste society that grew out of that Hindu worldview, where one person's identity is created by comparison with the other person that's in the lower caste or the higher caste so forth.
Yeah. So that kind of dysfunction, I think that's what we need to become more aware of, where we've trivialized our dysfunction in terms of, yesterday I said something that wasn't completely truthful, for example, and that's it. We've created these very discrete rocks on the beach. And that's the least of your worries.
Yeah, it's actually, ironically, it's minimizing our sin.
It's minimizing it. And for a lot of Christians too, they struggle with those big problems as if, oh, I've disappointed God, you know, 2 days ago, I just keep disappointing God and I'm not worthy. And there's that sort of sense of it. And you go, well, actually, that's the least of your worries, you know, like that's the... It's trying to the predicament that we're actually in as humans, the level of dysfunction, the level of sin. It's at such a deeper level than what we can ever be.
Which well, it's hopeless without the sacrifice.
It's hopeless and it makes us powerless. And that getting to that point, realizing that it's hopeless and that you are completely powerless. That will be where redemption begins, right there. I mean, this is, you know, it's the recognition of that. Because if, to the extent you think, well, I should just try harder or try and be better or, no, you can't any more than you could stop yourself falling out of the sky, you know, and don't look at other people and say, well, I'm better than that person. Yeah, but that person's falling out of the sky too. You might be falling, you know, slightly faster, but you're all, so don't be comparing yourselves to other people. It's that pervasive nature of the problem that brings us to that point of helplessness and hopelessness in ourselves that actually is the beginning of our redemption.
Yeah. And so this is where we then talk about then going to true self. It's a really interesting kind of way to understand the journey of salvation, because it's not like all of a sudden you become your true self, or it's not even like we are our true self, but just a little bit corrupt and we need to fix ourselves up around the edges. Thomas Merton's making the point that we don't even know who we are. We're so used to the false self that we've created. We actually have to have God work within us and reveal to us who we really are, and then allow him to pretty much reverse everything that we're used to living with, the whole kind of thing that drives us forward. All of those things, God needs to reverse them. We have to be able to let go of them. And then the journey of salvation is gradually chipping away, opening up the cracks to let the light of true self actually start to slowly emerge. And we're always going to be battling false self. But hopefully over time, we start to morph into the true identity that God gave us.
Which in a sense, we have that. Because our true identity, and this is a topic for a future episode, actually, is human identity. This is a big one, and we'll talk more about that. Our identity essentially is in our relationship with God.
Yeah.
You know, our identity, we need to understand identity as a relational thing, and it's primarily in our relationship with God. Now, Jesus has reconciled us with God, so it's there. Our identity is there, but it's the growth in that relationship is that progressive discovery, and it's like putting that old identity to death and allowing God to deconstruct that and actually build up out of our relationship with God our sense of new identity. Yeah. As I said, we have that, but we still need to realize that progressively.
And we don't necessarily, and this is where it came from the contemplative aspect of it, is that it's in there, but we actually are unaware of it really. It's so deeply hidden from us. It needs to be something that's revealed.
Yeah.
And so on. But the interesting thing is too, he actually paints, there's a huge amount of hope in that who I am is actually not really who I am. God has an identity for me, something else to step into. Yeah. So there's a huge amount of that incredible, you know, hope and optimism with that. But there's also like a kind of warning too, that there was something that he mentioned that really kind of struck me, was the idea that if we continue living and holding on to the false self and rejecting becoming our true identity. Imagine when we die, all the things that built our false self are all the things of the world.
Yeah.
It was our jobs and our relationships and aspirations and our wealth and the ego. All of a sudden, once we've died and now we're standing there and all of that's gone, is the moment we realize our life was one big mistake.
The emperor has no clothes.
Yeah. All of a sudden, that identity I have was completely false, a complete mistake, and I've failed to become the identity that God gave us, which now looking at it without the false identity now no longer being propped up, the true identity is what I was looking for.
Yeah, that's right.
And desired all along.
Yeah. Just to say something about that, because we've mentioned that book a lot. So Thomas Merton was a Catholic Trappist, a Catholic Trappist monk. Mm. Comes from he's coming from a Catholic background. Actually, I find myself resonating. Obviously, there's slight difference. There are obviously things in Catholicism that I would disagree with. I actually find his explanations. I find his explanations of even some of those Catholic elements really, really interesting. I think he's, in some ways, he's quite. He feels like a sort of a Protestant Catholic, if I can, even fairly evangelical in some sort of senses. So keep that in mind. That book, New Seeds of Contemplation by Thomas Merton, was, I think you're, discovering this too. It's one of the richest reads. It's like when I read this book, I thought this is a guy that stood on the mountain. I mean, he is, this guy's been there. He's not talking about some place that he hasn't been. I just found it profound. It's pretty deep stuff. It's not an easy read necessarily.
No.
But it's really good.
I know when I read it, it did challenge me to read it, because it's not necessarily from my own theological persuasion.
It's good though. That can be useful though, because it pushes against, because one of the things, we're going to get off. but he does push against the edges of things. I thought, actually, that's a really good critique of something that I, as an evangelical, have taken for granted, right?
Yeah.
But because he's in a different tradition, I think seeing that from his point of view is really, really valuable.
But I think the point I was going to make there is a sense of it's not coming at it because he's a Catholic. He's coming at it because he's had an he has spent time contemplating.
Yeah, he's very Christ-centered.
Yeah. And has experienced.
Yeah, that's right.
Something I haven't. He's accessed something that explains the core of general common understanding of Christianity, but just builds so much richness into a whole lot of ideas that I've taken for granted.
Not to mention his mastery of the English language. Yeah. I mean, he's a sublimely beautiful writer. Just want to go back to the consequences of the fall and the domino effect. So essentially what you get there is a sort of a social, you get the creation of, I guess, society, the roots of society, civilization, let's call it, as we now know it. So you get this breakdown. So what we've highlighted is the breakdown between us and God, because that's where we got our identity from. Our very being grows out of God, but we imagine, we became these sort of autonomous, independent units. And so that really messes up our identity, our sense of identity. We construct our identity artificially. We relate to each other as means to ends, in a sense. So I relate, it's not only the competitive element in that, but people are using other people as means to an end. It's interesting that when it talks about Cain after he kills Abel, he's driven off into the east, and it talks about him building the first city. And I mentioned this at the end of the last episode. Cities in the ancient world weren't like nice, living environments. They were forts.
Mm.
They were constructed by one group of people to protect themselves against the other group of people. Mm. So implicit there is this idea that you've got this tribalism amongst human beings, where they're building cities, now these fortified cities, to protect them against each other. And I also mentioned that's where historians like, Jared Diamond and others, who go right back to that transition from the Paleolithic period to the Neolithic period, that recognize a sort of monumental disaster. They point back to that period and they say there was a monumental disaster that happened, because previously, to a large extent, as they describe it, they see human beings living in harmony, relative harmony with their environment. But then suddenly you get this, well, not suddenly, but you get the emergence of tribalism, which leads to people gathering into groups and vying for limited resources and, forming cities, domesticating crops, which, severely impacts their malnutrition, you know, and they're much more vulnerable to drought and famine, therefore. They're also vulnerable to disease because they're cooping up animals in close confines and living with, you know, and so you get a lot of problems with that. So they, you know, a lot of these problems, including the back-breaking work, you know, backbreaking work involved in, you know, in farming as opposed to the sort of thing that human beings were doing before. So, you know, it's interesting in, you know, that these historians, and there's a whole number, there's another book that talks a bit about this and that I've mentioned before is Yuval Noah Harari's, he's an atheist intellectual, but his book Sapiens does a similar thing. You know, he talks about this transition and it's just... And, you know, he's summing up a whole lot of scholarship that's come before him as well. But it's interesting that they locate as kind of fall. And the American philosopher John Zazan, who is what's called an anarcho-primitivist, you know, which is basically a school of thought that problematizes civilization at the most fundamental level, that says that civilization is fundamentally corrupt because it has these corrupt roots. You know, we used to live in harmony with our environment, but the turn from the Paleolithic period to the Neolithic period really begins all of our problems. So they locate this fall in this, you know, at this particular point. Now, the interesting thing with John Zazan is that he refers to the Bible and the narrative of the fall as preserving the memory of that, right? Okay. Now, you know, of course, the question is the historian's description of it or is the biblical description of it the most accurate? And of course, we would say the biblical description is the most accurate, but it's interesting that these historians are, you know, sort of now universally recognizing that there was something essentially problematic that happened there. Yeah.
There's a pattern that's that they can see.
Yeah, and the implications of this are important. And to this extent, I agree with John Zazan, who I got in touch with him, actually, and because he's still alive. And you know, I said to him, there's a lot of resonance with the, you know, with some of the things that you're saying, and actually, you know, the biblical accounts and some and elements of theology. And anyway, I shared some of that. And he actually wrote back and said, look, I'm actually starting to realize some of this. And he said to me, I've been reading Thomas Merton. he said, it's Thomas Merton lately has been my spiritual journeyman.
Right.
So I'm thinking, wowzers, here's a guy that's gone from sort of atheistic, sort of anti, and you sort of get sense that in some of his earlier books, to actually realizing, realizing something there. Anyway, one of the interesting things that he does is that he, you know, he talks about civilization, the thing that we have celebrated in our culture without much sort of critical reflection. Well, civilization is better, you know, like, I mean, what he's doing is essentially questioning what he and a number of other people have been doing is questioning, well, is that actually better? And it goes back to the sort of colonialist mentality of, you know, we had civilization, we felt like we need to come and bring this and sort of force this civilization structure on these primitive peoples that were, that we had this fairly patronizing attitude and we felt we're sort of degraded and live this horrible, brutish sort of lives, you know, out in the jungles and the bush and the whatever. When actually they're saying, actually these people were living a lot more in harmony with their environment, and it's not, you know. And from a theological point of view, we would not want to idealize that. And certainly, the idealization of that primitive state, you know, begins with, you know, philosophers like Rousseau in the, you know, late 18th century and the 19th century, it was sort of fashionable, you know, this idea of the noble savage, you know, but that's the language that they used, of course, right, where they began to question these values of civilization. There was this sort of movement there and it was, you know, seen, these primitive states were seen as almost this kind of utopias, little utopias. And I think that was overstated. But the beginnings of the criticism of that Enlightenment commitment to creating a civilization that masters nature and that is can solve its all, you know, the idea of humanistic progress. And of course, one of the big problems that even missionaries made at the time is that they confused civilization with Christianity, that a Christian, you know, Christian world is a civilized world. Now they weren't completely wrong in the sense that Christianity actually enabled and empowered the building of our Western civilization,
yeah.
you know, with science. And well, this is
at a much deeper level than most people realize.
Yeah, that's
realize.
Right. Yes.
I mean, I was listening to Tom Holland.
Yeah.
Who's a lecturer on, because he's done a lot of research
yeah.
and stuff.
So his book Dominion makes this very case. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
And just goes through how entrenched that idea has been of the impact that, you know, Christian thinking has kind of infused itself into so many layers of society.
That's right.
That it has built a functioning, generally better, is what you're saying, is it's not necessarily, but it's like, but it's I guess we would, if you're an atheist making the case against religion and religion and Christianity being the problem, then actually the things that you think are good are because of the thinking, Christian thinking actually is planted in all of that, which has made it better.
Yeah, but that also gets flipped by critics of the sort of colonialist way of thinking, because they say that, you know, they sort of blame that, well, all these Christian ideas sort of got in there and it's just so human to take something good and to twist it.
Yeah.
You know, like there's no doubt, and this is the argument that Tom Holland makes, is that, you know, so many of the sort of powers that we possess as a civilization, you know, like even science and so forth, it actually, a lot of our civilization, you know, even our ability to construct stable, you know, economic environments and things like that, you know, does go back to sort of Christian, there are Christian roots in that, you know, the Protestant work ethic that has been spoken a lot about and so forth. So yes, there are good elements in that, but it's still, in a sense, and a good way of illustrating this is that it's like building a high rise. We've been civilizations like a high rise that we've been adding to, right? We've been getting better at building it, right? Mm-hmm. We've even used Christian principles to build, you know, society. Now, I know that's being stripped away in our current environment, but it's a high rise that's built on really, really shaky foundations. Mm-hmm. It's built on, you know, going back to Cain building the first city, and that's referring to the beginnings of sort of civilization. But civilization was built on sort of human autonomy and independence, and of course, the Tower of Babel is the culmination of that, really. And so, that sort of illustrates the kind of foundations, these shaky foundations that civilization has been built on. And, you know, essentially the argument of these anarcho-primitivist thinkers is that, you know, the whole thing is fundamentally, it's just not going to work, because it's like, so they're questioning the idea, the idea of, for example, the philosopher Steve Pinker, who wrote a book called Enlightenment Now, which is a sort of advocating this idea of humanistic progress. We're going to solve all our own problems. Things are getting better. Look how much things have gotten better in the world, you know, due to sort of humanistic progress. And yes, it is true. He can point to a lot of things that have genuinely gotten better. And, you know, to go back to my illustration, and we would say, and, you know, I would certainly argue, and Tom Holland, also Rodney Stark, the historian, would argue that Christianity has empowered a lot of those, you know, the getting better part. But still, we're getting better at building new stories on a building that is fundamentally problematic. And this is where a lot of these scholars, and this is connected a bit to pessimism, a more pessimistic view that is taken, you know, in view of sort of the destruction of the environment and so forth, because they're saying this just isn't sustainable. This whole way of living that we have constructed as human beings is completely unsustainable, and we've become like a kind of cancer on the earth, destroying, you know, we're destroying our own body in a sense,
right?
Destroying our own host. And there's an element of validity to that. So it really underscores the fact that the Bible points to that this whole thing, the world system, it's all going to crumble and fall one day. That's where the story ends. I mean, there's victory at the end for the kingdom of God, but the kingdom of this world, this whole world system, as we read Revelation, it's very clear that that all crumbles and falls, but the kingdom of God remains. And it's really important that we're living in the present, not putting our hope in this humanistic progress not playing the game, right? Because it's like, you know, this world is this game of identities and who's better than who and who's got the more status and you know, who's got the most toys. And this worldly game that's completely unsustainable, that is destroyed, that game has destroyed the world and is destroying the world. And yes, we have more resources and we're better at playing that game and more people have an equal share in the game. And so you can point to humanistic progress in that sense. But it's the wrong game. Like, it's the wrong game.
Yeah.
It's we shouldn't even be playing that game. And we're going to destroy ourselves. Who's and the world in that
game. And who decides what's better?
Yeah, exactly.
Who decides what's better? Because I think there are people, you know, if you travel overseas to less, you know, to third world countries, for instance, and you see the sense of community, and I hear more often people coming back from Pacific Island holidays where they're not in the tourist spots coming, man, those guys have got something I wish we had. Yeah. You know, we think we're better, but in fact, what is better, you know?
Yeah, that's right.
But there is a danger in this, so that we frame the human predicament as better, as in better society or betterment of society. Yeah. We're just to bring it back into
absolutely
to anchor it back. The real human predicament is all of those things are actually painting a picture of
the symptoms
of a symptom of a problem that doesn't really matter what we do, whatever we build, we make a mess of it. And the reason we make a mess of it is because deep inside us is
deep
sin that goes well beyond anything we can even comprehend.
Yeah.
And the real predicament is as a result of that, the separation from God.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
And where that's going to end up. There is, you know, where we sort of started off today as well, you know, you're talking about the visiting the sins of the different generations and so on. One of the things that would be interesting to sort of unpack that kind of almost builds an imagery of God just inflicting things on us, which I don't think.
No, that's
not
a
what
consequence
it is as well.
That he's talking about,
and I think there's another angle.
He's allowing
come at
a
this,
consequence, that's
which
right.
is to understand why does God allow those consequences and the weight of sin to bear down on us?
Yeah, that's right. One of the key takeaways, you know, I think here is that in the light of what we said about ourselves and our and the world in which we live. And this is just something that is trumpeted throughout the New Testament, is that we should never hope in our own abilities to fix our own problems. We cannot save ourselves. This is why we need Jesus so much, because our identity lies in God and Jesus reconnects us with God. He does that once and for all in that act of forgiveness, but it's this progressive reconnection in the sense that we grow in our relationship with God. That's where our identity is. But we also should not put our hope in this world system. And we can so easily do that. Oh, things are going to be all right. Things are going to get better. Things that, you know, we're meant to be really connecting ourselves and putting our hope in God's kingdom, what God is doing, and not in the things of this world. And I think that can actually be a liberating thing, because in our helplessness, in our need, that's when we really connect with what Jesus wants to do for us.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Thrive Perspectives. Our hope is that these discussions will challenge you to look at life from a new perspective. You'll find all our resources at the Thrive Today website, thrivetoday.tv. If there's a topic that you'd like us to discuss, please email us. Our email is contact@thrivetoday.tv. Until next time, our prayer is that you will thrive.